I don't, by the way, think writers have to know what the spine is. They do it intuitively.
In a way, it was Hemingway's theme, which is that style is enough.
When a director of Sidney Pollack's stature says, writers do it intuitively, I have to find the spine.
That the motions of grace are also the deepest movements of the soul.
He's being nice. Save him the trouble. Find the f-ing spine.
From Austin Film Festival and PRI Public Radio International, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and directors. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. On today's episode, filmmaker Paul Thomas Anderson moderates a conversation with Jonathan Demme.
Now the camera's rolling, the actors really own it.
Oh God, I don't even know how much time we have. We're just gonna keep jumping around.
5 hours.
Just because we'll have to talk about Silence of the Lambs.
And later in our program, film and television icon, Ron Howard.
Any movie you do, whether it's a fantasy or a broad comedy, they're all suspense pieces.
On Story will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Academy Award-winning filmmaker Jonathan Demme has given us the feature films Silence of the Lambs, Rachel Getting Married, and Philadelphia, documentaries featuring Talking Heads, Spalding Gray, and Neil Young, and television work as recent as 2013's The Killing, going as far back as the 70s TV classic Columbo. Filmmaker Paul Thomas Anderson moderated this conversation with Jonathan Demme, recorded at the 20th Austin Film Festival in 2013.
Jonathan is and always has been my favorite filmmaker. That when I was a kid and I found Melvin and Howard, it was like I saw somebody who had a voice that I thought mine sounded like. I liked the way he treated his characters and the way he moved his camera and the way he put music together with them. I thought, if I get to make films, I hope they'll look like that. I guess the question the thing I want to talk about is that look at your career, it has no discernible pattern at all. It's like completely.
My life's been like that too.
It's schizophrenic in the best way. You know, you've moved around. And did you have somebody that you looked at and said, I love the way that they've kind of treated this privilege of making movies? Or did these things just tumble forward and have you just followed your own rhythm? And how did it go, I guess?
I'm going to respond to that, but I also want to say that truly, you know, Paul, there's so many fantastic filmmakers making films today, and there's new ones coming up every minute. But I swear to God, for me, you're the most exciting filmmaker on the planet. So, anyway, I wanted to be clear about that. You know, it's funny, because I kind of fell backwards into filmmaking. I did some movie reviews and wound up getting a publicity job and having Roger Corman read my publicity stuff and wanted me to write a script and then giving me the opportunity to produce that script. And then when I got intrigued with directing, he let me direct and stuff. And so for me, it was just like I was doing this directing thing. I directed 3 pictures with Corman, and I was just so both thrilled to be doing this. And I adored movies from the first time I saw TV when I was like, you know, 3 when it was invented. You know, I was just like, oh my God, you know. And so I was just so thrilled to be doing it. I was also terrified because I didn't know what the hell I was doing, really. Luckily, I teamed up with Tak Fujimoto early on, and he did know what he was doing, but I didn't know what a director was supposed to do. And then over time, and I kept getting opportunities, I loved every script that I was offered the opportunity to do. I was just interested in making another movie. Mm-hmm. And I recognized the need to be enthusiastic about the script that you do. Because unless we do something that we really feel passionate about, and that can be a comedy like Married to the Mob, or it can be something that's the most important thing in your life, like making a movie about AIDS discrimination, you've got to have that enthusiasm in order to do good work. For me, anyway. Mm-hmm. The only way I'm gonna like do a good job is if I'm really passionate about it. Because if I think something's and other people might think it's It might be right, some of the stuff I've done, but I didn't think it was mm-hmm. So that's it. I followed my enthusiasm, and the opportunities have come my way, and every once in a while I've tried to stimulate, like Philadelphia got made because Ron Nicewander and Ed Sachs and I teamed up because we wanted to make a movie about AIDS. It's just been following the enthusiasm, and I like that I seem to have an eclectic, you know, filmography. And what I love about my filmography is that I do fiction films, and also documentaries, and also performance films, and also television. I know I'm a good director, and I'm mm-hmm. trying to get better and better everything I do every time out. So I'm glad I haven't repeated myself, and I think if that's part of what keeps me going.
I think the nice thing sometimes for me watching your films is that it's not like there's suddenly some shift in style, that if you're approaching a film that does have a serious issue like age discrimination, it wasn't suddenly that it seemed like it was directed by a very serious, important director, you know, that no matter what you do, you can't help but infuse yourself into these things, and there's always a great sense of humor in your work. A sneaky kind of exploitation element, and I just wonder, when you were doing those Corman films, the mandate in those days from him, I assume, was you've got to have some and you've got to have some guns, and it's got to be a certain length, and this is not your art project, and you know, am I more or less right when it comes to that? And was that at least feeding what your enthusiasms were at the time?
Well, the thing about the Corman movies, it was explicit. In case you hadn't noticed, you know, by the time you got to direct for Roger, all the movies had sex, violence, humor, and a little bit of social statement, if you could work that into the equation. Roger liked like that, but you knew you had to have that. So if you're writing a script, you had to have those elements on the page. And I was a fan of, you know, those things in movies. Mm-hmm. I feel differently about violence in movies anymore, but, you know, I was a fan of movie violence, make-believe violence, you know, dynamic violence like that. But stylistically, it's funny, because hearing you speak, you know, it's like you have a great, amazing visual style of your own, which isn't like anybody else's. There's certain kind of shots that you'll do and perspectives that you'll go to and times you'll choose to move the camera that are just like only yours. My visual style was I had aspirations for the kind of the classical Hollywood style. I wanted my movies to have dolly shots and look like movies by Raoul Walsh or, mm-hmm. you know, the directors that I really love, those Hollywood directors. So Tack and I, as our budgets got bigger, moving away from Corman, you know, he could get some more equipment and what have you. And so our style was evolving. And then we fell into this kind of exploration of subjective camera, which worked so nice in little tiny tastes from Hitchcock and from Sam Fuller. So we were like, well, why don't we see how much more you can use that, you know, mm-hmm. pulling the audience into the character's shoes and stuff. But then I started doing documentaries. And at a certain point, I got a little bit tired of the classical thing. You know, my version of classical mm-hmm. became a little predictable to me. And I knew this would be a good time to dolly in and all that stuff for emphasis. And I was making more and more documentaries, so that's when Declan Quinn and I did Rachel Getting Married Together. And I loved those Dogma films, the Scandinavian films, so much that just felt so real, you know. So we decided to shoot Rachel Getting Married, pretending it was a documentary. We had no pre-planned shots. Even Declan didn't know how he was going to shoot it. I'm just sitting at the monitor seeing what's going to happen next. The actors didn't know what was going to happen. So I made a big stylistic shift there. You don't. You just keep coming up with amazing shots that we've never seen before that work so expressively there. But I feel like kind of some of the TV stuff lately, I'm like, oh, this one should be more classical. Mm-hmm. Like I just did a pilot that I really enjoyed shooting for AMC called Line of Sight, and that's very classical, a lot of end of the camera, a lot of nicely manipulative, cool shots and stuff, and it turned out really good. So I enjoy working in different styles now.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. In the first half of today's program, filmmaker Paul Thomas Anderson speaks with Jonathan Demme about Demme's career spanning 40 years in the industry. In our next segment, Paul Thomas Anderson asks Jonathan Demme to describe a subtle but highly engrossing technique of cinematography made famous in Demme's films Something Wild and Silence of the Lambs.
God, I got so many questions. But just for a second, talk about subjective camera, when you started messing around with that, because I can remember you doing it a little bit in Something Wild. I remember it really particularly at the end when Ray Liotta gets stabbed, you know, and they're looking into the camera. So maybe there's a few other moments here and there that I'm forgetting, but when you did Silence of the Lambs, you really kind of grabbed it, and it was a very serious part of that movie. I guess I have a couple questions. Is how does that work when you tell an actor you're going to do this scene? It's not just like a shot into the lens. It's a probably 8 to 10 page scene into the lens. How did that sit the first time you threw that out there?
Yeah.
And did you maybe do it another way first and then talk them into looking into the camera? Just talk a little bit about that. Has anybody here not seen Silence of the Lambs, by the way?
But the thing is that what Paul's talking about, the subjective camera, in case you're not a crazed film buff like we are, that's when you show exactly what the character sees. You shoot it exactly from their point of view. And in doing that, you need a complement, which is them looking right into the lens. And in film grammar, that's going to translate into, that's what they see. If it's a dialogue scenes and you want to have the characters talking to each other, you need to have a couple of tight over the shoulders to work your way. You can't just suddenly crash in on those things. So you've got to sneak in and sneak out. But we started on Married to the Mob, in Something Wild. That's the only time in that, at the stabbing moment. But then in Married to the Mob, you know, this whole idea of, like, you want the audience to be in the character's shoes. Mm-hmm. Operating on the premise that the more deeply into the character's shoes the audience is, the more they're going to care about what's going on, the more they'll bond with the character. So we started kind of playing around a little bit more, because it's scary to have to ask the actors to act to the camera, to the lens. You know, they may think you're insane or something. So, you know, we started experimenting and doing scenes of two people looking at each other in a couple of places, and it worked. It was like, holy shit, you know, it was like Hitchcock does it, and Sam Fuller does it, and now I do it too, you know? And that was really cool. And also, it felt effective. So when we got to do Silence of the Lambs next, we decided to really commit to when Clarice is together with Dr. Lecter, we're going to have our, because the actors get used to the scene and the looser shots, and then they get more and more on it the tighter in you get. So by the time we get to the close-ups, which are going to be into the lens, they're really cooking now. And we decided to do entire scenes, and then we cut them that way in the cutting room. And what's great is that not one review, not one person ever said either, oh, that's weird, they're always looking into the lens, or, wow, that's cool, they're looking at us. Nothing. It was invisible to the moviegoers, because that means the story was working for them and the performances were working for them. That's the magic of actors, though, right? I mean, which is that the true, true magic to me of filmmaking are the actors. You know, we can go out and you can dream up your great shots and we can all do our thing, but now the camera's rolling, the actors really own it. And not only can they create this magic of creating a reality, they can even do it staring into a camera. It's wild. It's just wild.
Oh, God, I don't even know how much time we have. We're just going to keep jumping around.
5 hours.
Good. Just because we'll have to talk about Silence of the Lambs.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. After the break, filmmaker Paul Thomas Anderson asks Jonathan Demme about his films Silence of the Lambs, which won Academy Awards in all 5 major categories, and his Talking Heads live concert film Stop Making Sense. On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International will be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. We're back with filmmaker Paul Thomas Anderson speaking with Academy Award winner Jonathan Demme at the 20th Austin Film Festival in 2013.
Oh, talking about actors, trace two things. How you are faced with the issue of casting those parts. And because it's like you're not just casting one part, you're casting two essential elements directly across from each other, mm-hmm. and how you make that decision. And then the kind of boring question, which you probably answered as well, but how do you come to Silence of the Lambs? Because obviously that material had been worked with a little bit before, but how does that come to you? And at the moment after you'd made, you know, Something Wild and Married to the Mob, decide, this is material for me, and somehow I think I can do something with it. It's kind of wildly different from what you'd done just before. Mm-hmm. You know, drastically different from Married to the Mob. Those two things, just talk about those two things as the key components to that movie being so great. Yeah.
Well, you know, all these films that we're mentioning were made at Orion Pictures. And Orion was before your time. You hadn't started making movies yet. You were watching movies. Believe it or not, there was a time in the history of the industry where there was a company, and their thing was, we are financiers and we're distributors, but we're not filmmakers. You are the filmmaker. We like your script. What's it going to cost? It's going to cost that much? Okay. All right. Go. They got bought out by some conglomerate and something or other, and they wound up going bankrupt. But their thing was like, you know, we want our pictures to make their money back, and we hope that we're going to make a lot of money, but we're happy if we break even, because then we're functioning, and we're making films, and we have our jobs, and you have your jobs, and we need hits, but we're not, you know, Orion never had aspirations to like have huge revenues at the box office. I had done those two movies, Something Wild and Married to the Mob, and wanted to make another one, and I wanted to work with Danny Glover, and there was a script that came through, and it was a road rage script where Danny would have been victimized by somebody who got mad at him out on the road. And it was a good script, and I can't remember who wrote it, but it was good. And I thought Danny would be great in that part, and I took that to Orion and said, you know, Let's do this. And Mike Medavoy, who was kind of the creative head of Orion then, he read it and he called me up and he said, listen, if you want to make this, we will. But before we commit to this, there's something I want you to read. And actually, I'm not going to send you a script. I'm going to send you a book. And I was like, okay. And so he sends this book, The Silence of the Lambs. And everybody knows you can't commit to directing a book. You know, you have to have a script, and Ted Talley had started to work on the script, which I couldn't see yet. It wasn't going to be ready for months, but I read that book in one sitting and went, oh my God, this is a great novel. This is an extraordinary story, extraordinary characters. I love thrillers. So I said, yes, let's do it. Ted did a really good job on the script, and then it came time to cast it. And I thought for Dr. Lecter, I had one really commercial idea, which was Sean Connery. I thought he'd be an amazing Dr. Lecter, all that physical imposing. And he rejected it very quickly. He thought it was revolting, I think, was his thing. And then I thought, okay, so it's not going to be Sean Connery. And meanwhile, Al Pacino wants to do it, Dustin Hoffman, all these Morgan Freeman wants to do it. All these names are coming in. And I didn't even want to meet with anybody, but I did want to meet with Anthony Hopkins because I thought that, you know, in that movie, The Elephant Man, that he was the ultimate good doctor, just the greatest doctor of all. So my thinking was, what happens if the greatest doctor of all goes wrong? So we sent the script to Anthony, and he read it and loved it, and I went over to see him in London, and that was it. And the part of Clarice, I had had a really great time working with Michelle Pfeiffer on Married to the Mob. I thought she could do anything, which was my custom in those days, was I therefore gave it to Michelle first, and everybody liked her at Orion and was happy that she, you know, thought that Mob had worked out well. It was her first leading role. And Michelle was kind of yes, but also no. She was concerned about the darkness of the piece. She was going to do it, but then she wasn't going to do it. And she said, I'm just sorry, I just can't go there. So I was like, okay. Now, meanwhile, arising, Jodie Foster is so interested in this part, and she's called us, and she's come up to meet with us, and what about Jodie Foster? And I was like, you know, I don't think Jodie Foster would be good in this part. She's such a California person, and even she got her Oscar for, what was that movie called with the... Yeah, The Accused, and I didn't believe her Boston accent and stuff. I saw her acting all over the place, and I wasn't impressed, you know? But I agreed to meet with her, of course, you know, respectfully, so she came up. The Orion people wanted her very badly. And she was so, like, just like this, this kind of, Jodie was just like, she wasn't anything. She was just like this person, this normal person who came up. And she said, listen, I know that you're seeing other people. And I've heard that Michelle Pfeiffer might play it. And I just wanted to have the opportunity to tell you that I love this book so much. And I love this part so much. And the reason I love it is because, in you know, there's all these movies with men like, you know, going in and saving a bunch of people and doing one thing or another. But this story, Silence of the Lambs, it's about one young woman trying desperately to save the life of another young woman. And in order to do that, she's faced with the overwhelming obstacle of all these men. And they may be brilliant, or they may be, you know, but everywhere she turns, she's faced with this. She said, and I just think that's a great story. And so she left, and I went, that is rather a great theme. I think I'm going to take that theme and claim it, but I'm not going to cast her. And because now I wanted Meg Ryan to play the part. Harry and Sally had just come out, Joe and the Volcano stuff, and I thought, she's great. And I would believe her. I think she's a fabulous actress. I would believe her. I wouldn't believe Jodie Foster in that part. So the script goes to Meg Ryan, and word comes back very quickly, like, good God, I could never do a movie like that. She was slightly offended. So, and Laura Dern came in, and Laura was just it. I knew from the moment Laura came in that she was just, oh, my God. And I was like, wow. And she had, Laura had done like some little movies. And I told, you know, the folks at Orion, I said, you know, this is the one. And they were like, Jonathan, we're really worried about that in the context of Jodie Foster, who won an Oscar, who everybody loves, and she's desperate to do this, and you want to cast a relative unknown. She'd done Smooth Talk. Mm-hmm. So they said, please meet Jodie one more time. Meanwhile, somewhere there I met Demi Moore, who thought she had the job. She came in and she goes like, when do we start? And I was like, ooh, because she was a big star. I was like, so Jodie came back, and I'm sure that other filmmakers have had moments like this. I'm sure you have, but the moment came where I met Jodie again. I was no more taken with her at all. We chatted. And we said goodbye, and to me, it was saying goodbye forever. And you know, I went to the doorway, and I looked down the hallway, and I saw this young woman putting one foot in front of the other, walking on down the hallway, and I thought about how much she loved that part, and I thought how much my partners at Orion wanted her in that part. And I was like, I'll go with her. And look what happened. I mean, I just, you know, I fell madly in love with her. And she did what she did. And she embodied all that fierce. I named our production company Strongheart Productions after Jodie's, you know, sense of character.
How much do you count on or rely on moments like that happening if you're going into something? How much do you know that... Is it worth doing something if you know this is a story of a woman trying to save another woman and get through all these? Do you depend upon some instinct drawing you to a piece of material, and maybe you don't exactly know that part of it, and you're hoping it'll come to you, or you find those things?
Oh. I need a theme, as pretentious as that sounds.
No.
I I need, in order to make a good movie, I need a strong story, but I also have to know what it's about beyond the narrative. And all I knew was silence until I had that conversation with Jody, was it was a gripping suspense film, and but now I knew what to do, and I knew how to do it, and I knew how to shoot it. The thematic part is like so hoity-toity, but it's, no, you can't get away from it, right?
For more On Story, check your local PBS station for our television show of the same name. On Story gives you an inside look at the creative process from today's leading writers and directors. From Vince Gilligan discussing his show, Breaking Bad, to John Singleton describing the creation of Boys in the Hood. Every episode is a surprising and intimate look at filmmaking. Season 6 of On Story premieres in spring 2016, and all of our episodes are available online. Check your local listings, stream from PBS, or go to onstory.tv. Back to Paul Thomas Anderson and Jonathan Demme discussing the live concert film featuring Talking Heads, Stop Making Sense.
Stop Making Sense wasn't the first concert film you did, was it?
Yes.
I guess it was.
Yeah.
Well, first and best ever concert film. But then, yeah.
Thank you.
But how did you... How did that happen, and how did that kind of begin this kind of long resume now of performance films?
Well, that was crazy because Gary Getzman and I went to see the Talking Heads at the Greek Theater in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I already loved that band so much, and I'd seen the Heads in Central Park a year earlier at a daytime concert. Like, oh, my God, they're so great, and love their records. So we went to the show, and what I saw on stage was, I thought, literally a movie waiting to be filmed. There was this kind of this character-driven narrative going on with David, with the different kind of even costume changes and attitude changes, and the way the show brought the musicians on one at a time and visualized the development of the how that sound expands and develops and deepens. And also, there was also this amazing lighting going on, and I was like, I turned to Gary and said, dude, we should film this. So we tracked David's management down and had a meeting with David. David came out and met with Gary and I beside a swimming pool in the Hollywood Hills. And that was awkward. but, you know, and David said this thing to me. He's like, and how will this concert film be different from all other concert films? And I feel like such a poser anyway. So I was like, oh, God. So I was like, gulp. And I said, well, David, it'll be your band and your music, and I'll be directing it, you know? And he's like, you know? But they came back. The Heads came back and had talked to the folks at Warner's, so they were going to finance it. So we just did it. And TAC didn't want to do it. TAC was completely uninterested in doing a music film. So I reached out to Jordan Cronenweth, who I had had the privilege of working with on Citizen Band back in the 70s, and asked Jordy if he'd be interested in doing this. And part of the allure for David was that the lighting that he had, that was his lighting. He was working with a lighting director, but that was his lighting. And he was never able to know that the lighting as seen from the audience at the shows was what he was seeing in his head, because there's just a little too much ambient light in a rock venue. So now, if we made this film, he'd have the opportunity to see the lighting that he had always seen as one. I never talked to Jordy about the light. David talked to Jordy about the light. We shot at the Pantages Theater. And the first night, I was like, talk about learning on the job. It was like, okay, we'll have the light up on the, you know, Jordy, can you do the stage, make that lighting okay, but can we have enough light on the audience so we can film the audience? And so, you know, and he could thread that needle. And the first night, the concert was horrendous. It was a debacle because the audience had lights on them and cameras pointing at them, and they weren't giving good feedback, mm-hmm. and the band felt that, and it was disastrous. And, you know, at the end of that show, it was like, okay, no more light on the audience. And from this moment, this thing I love to do, which is never show the audience, was born. So the moviegoer gets to feel like this is for you. This wasn't for those people you see rocking out, or not rocking out in that case. Mm-hmm. So that's how that was born. And I also wanted to shoot it like a feature film and not do a bunch of quick cuts, which had become pretty fashionable already on TV and what have you. But just rather shoot it with, you know, expressive camera work and what have you. And Jordy gathered a bunch of fantastic operators, and we went out on a mini tour the week before we were going to shoot, because I wanted to test certain angles, and I wanted to write a script so that it would literally have a script of where the camera would be for at every moment at every song. And two young filmmakers from Austin, Texas, came out and operated these cameras. Both of them died very, very young, tragically, as when anyone dies young. And they're two fantastic filmmakers, one named Brian Hansen, the other named David Boone. And David Boone made Invasion of the Aluminum People, and Brian made an extraordinary movie with Paul Collum and others called Speed of Light. And I saw those films when I first came to Austin in the, I guess, the late 70s, at the invitation of Lewis Black and the Film Society. And, you know, Lewis and I became instant great friends, and he introduced me to all these young filmmakers. And we went over to somebody's house and watched all these films. And some of them, a couple of them, were phenomenal, including these two. This is always a hotbed of filmmakers, Austin. And music makers, always. It just is. It's in the DNA of this city that, you know, there's great filmmakers and great musicians and great bands. And most of these guys were also in bands. This was like at the height of the new wave thing. And Austin had the greatest music scene of any of, and there was a lot of great music scenes in those days, back in the 70s and the 80s. But Austin had it, you know. So I invited these guys up to New York. I was on the board of the Collective for Living Cinema, and we had an evening of new films from Texas. And now, I'm sure that very few of the, anybody here in Austin, including, you know, the filmmakers, I'm sure that very few people have ever heard of Brian Hansen and David Boone, these kind of seminal Texas filmmakers, you know. So they came out, and oh God, that was a tangent, but it had to be said.
No, I was hoping you'd go there.
Yeah. So I wrote a script of where the camera was going to be. And I was going to be in the booth, and I was going to rehearse it with the cameras, and I was going to count down to camera C. This is your moment to be here. We had shooting plans and stuff. And that happened, and it was good. But what also happened was that with these great operators who didn't have a specific assignment at that moment, because, you know, A camera was going to be the one in the film, so B, C, D, and E were just shooting. So amazing things happened on those other cameras. And the finished picture wound up probably like 50% pre-scripted, mm-hmm. and the other 50% just this gorgeous, gorgeous, amazing stuff that happened. That's the last time that band ever played together. So it's really right place, right time syndrome, you know, once again. You know, had we not done that film, there wouldn't be a record of how great that band was and what a genius David is.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International is also available to stream or download. Subscribe now to get parts of our show you might have missed, or reach back into our early days with over 60 episodes available online. On Story can be found on your favorite podcast app, iTunes, Stitcher, or at onstory.tv. We'll be back in a moment with film and television icon Ron Howard. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. Ron Howard began his acting career in 1956 at age 2 and came to prominence playing Opie Taylor on The Andy Griffith Show in the 1960s. Under the careful tutelage of his father, film and television legend Rance Howard, Ron Howard went on to build extensive acting credits before directing his first short film, Old Paint, in 1969. Since then, Ron Howard has gone on to act in, direct, or produce more than 130 films and television series, including some of the most memorable of the past 40 years. This conversation with Ron Howard was moderated by Castaway and Apollo 13 screenwriter Bill Broyles on October 24th, 2009, at the 16th Austin Film Festival.
If you look at Ron's filmography, it's an extraordinary thing. You have everything from popcorn movies like The Da Vinci Code to serious political dramas like Frost Nixon, fantasies like Willow, romantic comedies, Splash, a Western, The Missing, classic drama like A Beautiful Mind. So what is a Ron Howard movie?
You know, I started off acting on TV shows, Andy Griffith Show and then and Happy Days. You begin to realize part of the job of the writers, the directors, and the actors is to acknowledge that you're developing a premise that works. And each episode is basically a sequel. I mean, you're basically trying to feed people that thing that they like in a slightly different way. And, you know, evolutions are slow, and but the tone is supposed to remain consistent. I saw my dad directing plays. He never directed film, but he used to direct theater in the Los Angeles area. A lot of the directors on the Andy Griffith Show had been actors, almost all of them. And I became very interested in the whole process. I was exposed to a lot of the writing process because the cast of the Andy Griffith Show was allowed to hang around for an hour or so after the read-throughs and hear the writers start to talk about it and hear Andy and others with real clout talk about, you know, scenes that were bothering him and why. And it was a great, great education. But I also began to see what the camera was about and the sound people and every other phase. And I saw that the director was the person who was kind of getting to play with everyone and interact with everyone. And that job just looked good to me. I did fall in love with the medium of movies and the different kinds of stories that could be told and the different kind of feelings that you could draw from an audience. I was feeling it as a movie goer as I moved into my teens, and I really wanted that experience, and I didn't necessarily feel empowered to do that. I didn't feel I had the talent, or it wasn't really my responsibility as an actor to feel ownership over those kind of moments and that kind of audience reaction. So I really wanted to take on the responsibility. It was something that appealed to me. Once I realized I was going to have a career as a director, the only sort of careerist decision I ever made was that I was going to try to prove to myself and to the creative community I could tell all kinds of stories. I admire a lot of filmmakers, but probably Billy Wilder the most for that range and that ability to explore various genres. And I really have pursued that. It's not my primary interest anymore. In fact, it kind of ended in some ways with Apollo 13. That was a pivot point for me. I learned a lot about storytelling. I learned a lot about myself, learning to trust the audience, because it was in many ways a very sophisticated story, you know, and we, the screenplay dictated, as did the actors, and the having all the astronauts, you know, around. I kept sort of checking that desire to sort of play to the audience and instead just tell the story. And we had such great response to that film that I took that on. And in the last, you know, 10, 12, 13 years, I've really continued to work on a variety of films, but now it's so much, it's never an exercise. Now it's always a story that I believe in and that I believe I can bring something to, and a subject or a set of characters that I'm fascinated by for a variety of reasons. What I care about is just trying to understand the possibilities of the story, really come to understand it and look at the resources, the tools, the talent, the amount of money that we have to work with, and just try my best to apply those resources in a way that fulfills the possibility of the story for its sake, for my sake, and for the audience's sake. And whatever that is, I hope I really work to try never to impose really anything of myself on the movie.
So since this is a screenwriting conference, I think it'd be really interesting for the audience just to get some insight into how you pick a script. And it's, what is it about a script that comes across your desk that leaps out at you and says, I have to make this movie?
Wow. Well, it is, when I was reading Apollo 13 the first time, it was a very dense, complicated script. It wound up going through lots and lots of drafts and work and so forth. And certain things, you know, worked better than others in my mind. And so I'm reading it, and I was actually taking the train from my house into New York, the Metro North line, and it was crowded, and I was standing, just jammed in, and reading, and I got to the end, and the chutes opened, and I knew the chutes were going to open, but I started to fight off tears standing there next to a bunch of commuters, and I just remember feeling that something that adds up so powerfully really has a wonderful chance to be a remarkable movie. And at that point, I really wouldn't have ever let anyone else work on it. And I think there's a point when I'm considering a project, and of course, my partner Brian is very important. His advocacy or his criticism of a project that I'm considering is important to me. Same with my wife, Cheryl, who's always been a kind of a very important creative secret weapon for me. If a script reaches a certain point where, despite the various landmines that I've learned to identify, and by the way, those landmines don't always turn out to be the problem that you think they are when you're reading the script, which is really frustrating, but you got to bet on something, and so you're reading and you're guessing that this is a problem and this is a strength and trying to weigh it. When it reaches a point where I think, if I let it go, I know it's good enough that somebody else is going to make it, can I stand the idea of anyone else getting to do the film? And so it's that jealous greed.
Yeah. And no way happens, Steven Spielberg is going to get this movie.
Then you might as well make the movie. Then that means you have to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because it's a movie that deserves to be made. But it really is, you know, I think it's the combination of a subject and a setting and the characters. And I mean, I know that's so simple. But then the other thing, and this is what we really honed, in fact, and worked on a lot, and I learned a lot about with Apollo 13, which was such a kind of a sprawling story, was the need to find ways to create suspense. And I decided from that point on, any movie you do, whether it's a fantasy or a broad comedy or a drama or an action, that they're all suspense pieces. And when you see something that is doing that page-turning thing, a scene ends and it's pulling you into the next one, and the characters are surprising you in some way, and it's not unfolding in just, you know, ways in which you would predict or expect, then you really feel like you're onto something very, very, very special. And those are the kind of movies that I love to see. And when I can find it in a script, you know, I begin to want to build around that and make the film.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. I'm your host, Brian Ramos. In the second half of our program, we'll hear, in our next segment, Ron Howard discusses character, collaboration, working with actors, and sustaining tension in every genre.
9 times out of 10, people kind of guess the ending. I mean, almost all of us know it's going to wind up being one of 2 or 3 things, even in fiction. The key is to invest the audience in the journey that the characters are going on. So it's not even so much a matter of what the outcome will be, but what it's going to be like for them in reaching that conclusion. And how will they be once they get there? In the broadest terms, maybe they'll live, maybe they'll die, but will they be broken? Will they have lost something that we care about? Will they be vindicated or validated in some way? What is the human journey going to be? When you start to delve into those central characters and understand what's making them tick and make the audience relate to them as human beings, whether they're the people you're rooting for or the people you're rooting against, if people stop thinking about that and they become focused on the details of the scenes and what they're learning about the characters and how they're relating what their own experience might be to facing some level of adversity like those characters are facing. And then I think the other thing is to occasionally move away from the central characters and invest emotionally in characters who are observing it, who have a deep emotional connection with what the outcome will be. I think those two things mean a lot. With Frost Nixon, I saw the play, I loved it, it was riveting, but immediately, as I was watching the play, I remember feeling that we could do more with the secondary characters, just a little bit more, if we could cut to them in the viewing room, if we could understand how invested they are in the outcome of these interviews. It'll break down the distance that we have and create some relatability if you can't relate to characters as iconic as Nixon or David Frost. It seemed, again, to really work. So if I think I understand on some thematic level what there is that's interesting about what the characters are going through that I either relate to or I think I understand, then I think I have a way in to sort of developing a point of view for the movie. And when you have that, then whatever the tone, whatever the genre, it starts to be something more personal. And if anything is going to be entertaining on any level, comedy or drama, it has to carry a message. It has to present some ideas. And whether they're, you know, silly or sophisticated. But you have to understand them in order to present them. And that's a very important thing to me in reading a script. I really love to try to create an environment where there is a collaboration, there is this spirit, this kind of open dialogue, and it's supposed to be a place that's as safe as possible for people to take creative risks, and I want them to feel like in this environment they really have a chance to excel, and there aren't impediments to their really putting their best foot forward. That's a kind of a methodical thing because different people work in different ways. Once you've begun filming, if you've got everyone pulling creatively in the same direction, because everyone sort of understands what the big ideas in the film are and what we're going for, suddenly everyone's contribution becomes more and more valid. And you wind up having to say no to people fewer times. And so when you do say no and reject somebody's idea, they're very comfortable with it because they know that we're operating in a spirit of a director who's willing to say yes. I was getting a chance to direct a TV movie in Dallas, in fact, starring Bette Davis. And I was really kind of terrified by this. And early on, she was kind of wanted to do the role, but she didn't like a few things in the script. She didn't like some of the ways that I was casting it. She was kind of challenging me in various ways. And she kept calling me Mr. Howard. And I've said, well, Miss Davis, this is on the phone. I hadn't met her in person yet. I said, Miss Davis, please just call me Ron. And she said, I will call you Mr. Howard until I decide whether I like you or not. And hung up. So you could see I was losing sleep. And I was, you know, probably 25, 26 years old at the time. And I was talking to my father about it, and who'd worked with a lot of greats along the way and been on a lot of sets. And he said, trust me, that she's great. And that means she wants to be directed. And she needs to know that you're ready to direct her. And you don't have to bully her or anyone, but do your homework, be prepared, and build that trust, but do it with confidence. Well, it turned out to be the greatest advice ever. And it's not about being stubborn or digging in. On the first day of actual filming, we got through one rehearsal day, and it was Mr. Howard all day, but it was all congenial. The next day of filming, we're out here on this tarmac outside of Dallas. It's August. It's, you know, it's 8:15. It's already 98 degrees. It's going to hit 100. And I came walking up behind her. She was sitting there in the set. And to give her a direction, because I didn't quite like what she was doing in the first couple of rehearsals. And she turned around and with a start. And she went, oh, you frightened me. And then loud enough for the crew, you know, she said, oh, I was so, pardon me, I was so frightened. I saw this child walking up behind me. And I couldn't help but wonder, well, what of any consequence could this child possibly have to say to me? And she laughed, ha, 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 for the crew. And so I kind of laughed myself, ha, ha, I popped the Tums or something. But I leaned in and I gave her the direction. And she made the adjustment. And she was a little, you know, tense about it, but she did it. The day went on. We just kept doing that, you know. It was a TV movie, so we were doing a lot of scenes in one day. Finally, toward the end of the day, I said, Miss Davis, I don't think you should cross from here to there on that line. I think you should try this other point, and that's going to set up a camera angle change that I want to make. And I explained it. And she said, oh, I don't think that'll work. No, but I'll try it. I'll try. I'm always the director's kid. And she did. We tried a rehearsal, and she did just what I asked her to do. And she stopped the rehearsal and in front of everybody said, you're right. That is so much better. Thank you. And we went ahead and finished up that scene. And when the day was over, I said, well, Miss Davis, you're wrapped. We still have a couple of shots to do. But thank you. Great day. I'll see you tomorrow. And she said, okay, Ron, see you tomorrow. And patted me on the ass. So, in answer to the question, different actors work in different ways, and it is really important to understand that. I was talking to Joe Torre. I like to talk to coaches. And he said, well, starting pitchers are different. And you have to understand that. Everybody else has one set of rules. Starting pitchers are, they're a different breed. And you got to understand that. Here's a guy who was a, you know, a world-class catcher as well as being a manager. Well, actors in lead roles are as well. And they really are artists. And they are, and it's frightening. And I understand how terrifying it is to act. So I try to be protective, but also work in the spirit of always moving things forward with kind of a level of practicality. And you just have to understand. And sometimes you realize certain actors are great with virtually no rehearsal, and other ones need rehearsal and a few takes to get going. And so you just begin to work it that way. And you begin to shoot, you know, you shoot one person's coverage right away while they're fresh. You give the other chance person the chance to do the off camera and kind of warm up into it. You know, and you begin to see what the artists have to offer and how you can, again, help them to excel. And it's really exciting. I never had a more extreme example of it than on Cocoon, where the four lead guys were just so different. There was Wilfred Brimley, a really intense but brilliant improvisational actor who claimed he never even read the script, which, of course, is, I don't think I buy that. But a brilliant improvisational actor. Hume Cronin, a theater star and a playwright. Very formal. Everything's organized. Don Ameche, who was an old-style Hollywood actor, which meant you know, hit the mark and say the lines. And then Jack Gilford, who was kind of a vaudevillian, you know, and just kind of a light comedian. And they were very uncomfortable with Wilford's improvisation. And as I took them all aside, and I just quietly said, I really like the script, and I always want to do the script, but I also really like the kind of the exchange and the energy and the naturalism that we're getting with Wilford. And then I might do the director thing and saying, by the way, I don't think he's so good when he just does the script, you know. So we have to help him out. We got this great balance. And our writer, he wasn't ultimately the credited screenwriter, but he did a lot of great rewrite work on it, a guy named Dennis Klein, who came out of television. He was literally on the side during rehearsals in the first week of shooting when he was there, slipping Don ad-libs, little pieces of paper, so Don could just start to ad-lib. And everybody, hey, good one, Don, and made him feel a lot better. So for me, those kind of environments are exciting to try to work with and create. And it's just, again, it sort of reflects the approach that that I take in trying to utilize the resources that are available for a project to try to fulfill its possibilities.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Clayburgh Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. Generous support is also provided by the City of Austin Cultural Arts Division, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, and the Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Our executive producer is Barbara Morgan, and the show is produced and edited by myself, Brian Ramos. I do the music for the show as well. Our associate producers are Aaron Halligan, Sonia Onescu, and Maya Perez. Our production coordinator is Katie Stewart, editing help from Jamal Knox. Production assistance from KUT 90.5 in Austin. You can learn more about the Austin Film Festival at austinfilmfestival.com. Until next time, I'm Brian Ramos, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.